You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now, a shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
On the program today, goods, durable and otherwise, oil, its price and our discontent, and we will end with chocolate. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday, today the 27th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with a surprise. From the Commerce Department this morning came the August report on orders for durable goods. Big, expensive things that are built to last. Vehicles, machinery, appliances, computers, that kind of stuff. Anyway, we had been expecting a drop last month, just like we saw in July. Silly us, orders were up just a bit, but up nonetheless, 0.2%. You take transportation orders out, overall durable goods were up 0.4%. Now, why take transportation out? It's a totally fair question. You take transportation out because that mostly means airplanes, and orders for big passenger planes are really volatile. They jump around month to month, so much so, in fact, that there's a school of thought that says aircraft orders are so volatile that we should just ignore them because big swings in data don't really tell us all that much. So Marketplace's Justin Ho looked into why aircraft orders are so volatile, first of all, and then what that can actually tell us about the broader economy. Here you go.
Ordering an aircraft is a lot different than buying a car or even a house. Samuel Engel with the consulting company ICF says if an airline wants to order one Boeing 737 MAX 8, they face a list price of about $120 million.
It's something that takes place after not just very careful consideration, but also after intense negotiation.
Engel says airlines can negotiate those prices down by ordering a bunch of aircraft at once.
The airline Indigo in India ordered 500 aircraft in 2023. You saw, United last year ordered 200 aircraft from Boeing. So these are really large orders.
And large orders only happen once in a while. It's not like United's going to order 200 aircraft every month. Engel says airlines tend to cluster their orders around big industry events like the Paris Air Show in June.
And that doesn't mean that when there are no orders announced in July, that demand has fallen off.
But while aircraft orders jump around every month, there's a steady pipeline of aircraft being made all the time to fulfill those orders. In fact, aircraft manufacturers tend to have big backlogs, says Kevin Michaels, managing director of Aerodynamic Advisory.
If you're ordering an A320 from Airbus, you could be waiting 8 years until you get delivery if you get in line today.
Michael says one aircraft order is really thousands of orders for all the parts and materials that go into an aircraft.
You know, for certain materials, it can take over a year to just get delivery of those materials. And that's before you even start cutting metal and creating a part.
Every single one of those parts is created by a manufacturer with its very own supply chain. The airplane industry breaks this up into a hierarchy with manufacturers who supply the aircraft makers themselves at the top.
We would be a tier one supplier.
That's Colin Mahoney, president of customer and account management at Collins Aerospace, which makes everything from engines and landing gear to the stuff you see when you walk inside an airplane.
look to the left, you see the flight deck, all those fancy displays and two seats where the pilots sit. We do all of that. Look ahead, you've got the galleys, the fridges, the ovens, the coffee makers. We do all of that.
Mahoney says his company makes a lot of those parts in-house, but it also works with a long list of other suppliers. A long list.
It's four digits. You could say it's in the thousands. No, it's a non-trivial amount.
And every time a Tier 1 supplier needs a part, a Tier 2 supplier gets to work.
This is our embroidery machine here.
That's Joe Medeiros, supply chain director with San Diego Aircraft Interiors in Chula Vista, California. The company makes aircraft seat covers. Right now, machines are cutting out pieces of fabric, and workers are sewing them together. This embroidery machine is stitching an airline's logo onto a headrest cover.
We could do multiple colors in it, multiple style, different fonts, everything. Whatever the customer desires, we will replicate onto their product.
Medeiros sells his products to seat manufacturers and to the airlines themselves. He says his seat covers are typically the last thing that gets installed on an airplane. But that doesn't mean his company is at the end of the aircraft supply chain. He has suppliers of his own.
We buy from manufacturers of ultra leather. There's a few in the world that do the high quality leather like that. As well, there's thread, there's foam, there's different types of foam I put in the seat.
Medeiros says from the moment an airline orders an aircraft, it might be 3 years before his business gets an order for seat covers. But when it finally comes in,
it supports our 50 employees here as well as their families. But it also supports our local suppliers. It helps bring revenue to the city, tax dollars and such.
In other words, the number of aircraft orders this month can be an indicator of how business will look years from now. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, turns out whatever agita traders had yesterday, it's all gone. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I've said this before, but it bears repeating anytime oil prices are the topic of conversation, as they are about to be. We produce, globally, about 100 million barrels of oil a day. We consume, globally, about 100 million barrels of oil a day. Supply and demand made real, right? I mention that because crude is bumping up against $100 a barrel right now, with guesses it's going to go higher soon and maybe for a while. Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall looks at how that'll do across the whole economy, just as the Fed is trying to do what it is trying to do.
The pump is the first place Americans would feel higher oil prices, says University of Houston Energy Fellow Ed Herz. I caught up with him right before he was filling up his own tank.
I'm at a location with $3.75 a gallon gasoline.
He says as prices continue to rise,
discretionary spending, the runs to the fast food outlets will probably diminish first.
Colin Hendricks with the Peterson Institute for International Economics says high prices likely won't do much to suppress overall economic growth, but the poorest Americans will feel the pinch.
Energy expenditures are a significant portion of consumer spending.
People may opt for public transit, which depresses retail spending.
And tends to drive up online kind of shopping.
Energy-intensive industries will also suffer, says Ana Maria Herrera, an economist with the University of Kentucky.
Rubber and plastics, right? So lots of what they use or chemicals is oil in their production process.
She says for now, the situation isn't as severe as with previous price hikes. Even so, higher prices do complicate the Fed's attempt to cut inflation, says NYU economist Mark Gertler.
They might keep rates this level for longer. Increasing costs puts pressure on firms.
Ed Hurst says the U.S. is more self-sufficient in oil now than in previous decades.
The U.S. is almost back up to a level of record production, over 13 million barrels a day.
And he says oil-producing areas like West Texas and the Dakotas will benefit from the higher oil prices. I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
Here's a little tidbit from the durable goods news we started with today. Furniture that you buy for your house or your apartment, a bookcase maybe or a dining room table, not a durable good, says the Commerce Department. Office and institutional furniture, yes. The stuff you pay for, no. Which kind of fits, because a lot of the furnishings that have been bought and sold lately ain't built to last like they used to be. Rachel Curzius had a story in the Washington Post the other day about the perishable nature of a lot of furniture nowadays. Rachel, good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but what did happen to furniture in this country?
Well, Kai, it's not great. I think anyone who's purchased new furniture recently can tell you that often it just doesn't last very long. It used to be made out of solid wood. It used to be made out of domestically produced plywood. And now we're seeing more particle board. We're seeing worse quality plywood. And that has an impact on how wobbly furniture is, because things are designed to be put into pieces, they often end up in pieces as well.
Used to be that the great state of North Carolina was a furniture hub in this country, right? Great stuff would come out of there, well made by artisanal craftsmen and people who knew what they were doing. All of which is to say, this is kind of a labor story, too.
This is absolutely a labor story. And I think that it comes back to the idea that as soon as distance no longer became part of the equation, as soon as it was less expensive to ship things internationally than it was domestically, then there wasn't this idea that, hey, we should pay people in the United States to do this work. Instead, companies were chasing bigger profit margins, which they were able to do by producing furniture and other goods internationally.
Can I just ask you about the thing you said up at the top, you know, the stuff that shows up in pieces at our doorstep that we then have to assemble often winds up in pieces. There was a staggering statistic in this piece about how much furniture waste goes into landfills every year in this economy. It's like millions and millions and millions of pounds.
Yes. The Environmental Protection Agency estimates that nearly 10 million tons of furniture ended up in landfills in 2018. It used to be that if you had a sofa and it needed to be refurbished, you could reupholster it. These days, it's generally less expensive to just buy a whole new sofa than to hire someone domestically to reupholster your couch.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. We inherited some chairs from my wife's grandmother, and they weigh a ton. We had to get them sent out to reupholster, and they're hugely, hugely heavy.
The heaviness,
Go ahead, Kai. Go ahead.
I feel like the heaviness is part of the story here, too, because when people move around so much, it doesn't necessarily make sense to be carting an armoire made of solid oak up and down six flights of stairs. So there is some benefit to having lightweight furniture. The problem is with flat pack shipping, where you're putting it together yourself, you can't take it apart and then put it together again and expect it to still last.
Yeah, no. Once you put together those IKEA cabinets, they're staying together. They're not coming apart for the move. So, which gets me to my last question. Speaking as a guy who has had and now does have several IKEA cabinets, not to, you know, dump on them, but they're the one that come to mind. I've got those cabinets in my house. And so the question is, what is our furniture future? Is this just where we are now with more cheaply made and less lasting stuff?
I want to dig into the IKEA mention briefly, just because I think IKEA gets a really bad rap here. In speaking with vintage furniture purveyors, all of them said, just as a given, new furniture is not like it used to be. It's not like it used to be. And then if you look on the vintage furniture market, you'll see that IKEA furniture from the 80s is an extremely hot ticket right
now.
Wow,
that's crazy. That's funny.
So it's not that IKEA is the cause of all of our consternation here. Another thing that I note about that is that when these changes started happening, IKEA didn't really have enough market share to really be able to shift the game in the way that we're talking about now. So,
okay, All right.
IKEA's getting a bad rap here.
All right. All of that noted, and mea culpa on IKEA, but the question stands. No, I appreciate the correction, right? Because I had no idea. But is this sort of our future now, the less lasting furniture, do you think?
It's up to us. You can still buy domestic solid wood furniture if you choose, but the reality is you're going to spend more money on it. It's not going to come as quickly, and it's going to be heavier. A great place to buy long-lasting furniture is a vintage furniture store, right? The proof is in the pudding that it's well-made because it's lasting long enough for you to be able to purchase it right now.
Including IKEA stuff from the 80s, which just kind of blows my mind. Rachel Curzius at the Washington Post. Rachel, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Kai.
Coming up.
No one I know is giving out truffles and fancy chocolate to trick-or-treaters.
Yeah, no, I'm not sure kids are looking for that, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 68 points, about 0.2%, 33,550. The NASDAQ up 29 points, just over 0.2%, 13,092. The S&P 500 added just shy of 1 point, basically flat, 42.74. Elizabeth Trovall was telling us about $100 a barrel of oil and what that might do to the economy. West Texas Intermediate certainly headed in that direction, up 3.75% today. And the threat or the promise of $100 a barrel of oil is doing wonders for oil stocks. That's the way that goes. Chevron added almost 2% today. ExxonMobil gassed up 3.25%. Gassed up, that's pretty good. Bond prices, real quick, down. The yield on the 10-year T-note went up. Hello, Jay Powell, 4.61%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Ascensus, helping people dream bigger, aim higher, and save more with financial confidence. Unleash the power of your retirement savings plan with innovative technology that makes things easy, top-notch service from experts who care, and flexible solutions that can grow with you. For more than 40 years, Ascensus has been helping savers achieve their goals. We can help you achieve yours, too. Learn more at Ascensus.com. That's ASCENSUS.com.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Federal wildland firefighters, there are about 19,000 of them, got a raise last year. As much as 50% of their existing pay, up to a $20,000 cap, whichever's less, thanks to the bipartisan infrastructure law. It was all about helping the U.S. Forest Service, the Department of Agriculture, and a handful of other agencies hire and retain more firefighters as the wildfire season gets longer and wildfires themselves burn hotter and more destructively. That money, though, for the raises is running out. And while there is bipartisan support in Congress to permanently bump up firefighter salaries, Congress is a little distracted right now. Marketplace's Savannah Marr has more on that.
Pete Dutchick fights fire for the U.S. Forest Service. He could double his salary by moving to a state agency. That's what a lot of his colleagues have been doing. But he loves his work.
The reality is, though, as staffing levels continue to drop, it's harder and harder to get all the work done that needs to be done.
Cardell Johnson looked at this for the Government Accountability Office.
Firefighters are taking multiple deployments. Fires might burn longer, and it might take a longer time to get put out.
He says understaffing intensifies some of the working condition and work-life balance issues that make people want to quit in the first place. Kamiko Barrett, the lead wildfire policy analyst at Headwaters Economics, expects many federal firefighters to move on rather than take a pay cut in the coming weeks.
And you'll see at the same time concurrently rising wildfire risks.
Because of the changing climate, and
likely the immediate federal response will be to direct what resources are available on suppression.
That means suppression of fires that are already burning, rather than thinning forests and other badly needed fire mitigation. And Randy Irwin, president of the union that represents many federal firefighters, says the political back and forth is hard to take.
You know, it's very demoralizing.
With a shutdown looming, he says firefighters who remain fear they'll wind up continuing their dangerous work without pay, only to have their salaries slashed when a government shutdown comes to an end. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
You go to buy something in this economy, you want to know what it's going to cost. That's just kind of the way it works. There's really not much haggling anymore. But when it comes to one of the biggest purchases a lot of families make, a college education, what that's going to cost is pretty opaque. We're not talking about the sticker price here, which can be eye-watering. Yes, we are talking net price after scholarships and grants. According to the Government Accountability Office, more than 90% of American colleges either understate the net price in their financial aid letters to students, or they don't say what the net price is at all. This week, though, we learned more than 360 schools have committed to make those aid offers more transparent. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has that one.
Students and parents have a lot of numbers to crunch as they make decisions about college. So some of them turn for help to Jennifer Jesse. She's a college consultant in the Washington, D.C. area.
To see which school is going to put me in the best position to avoid debt. And then you want to make an educated decision. It's higher and it's worth more to me, or it's not worth more to me.
One kind of tool Jesse uses to figure that out are the financial aid offers students get every year. But she says they often don't provide enough information.
Some colleges will put the loans on the offers, some won't. And then some don't even have the net price at the bottom.
The new voluntary standards are supposed to help with that problem. Justin Drager is president of the National Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators, which is managing the initiative.
The school needs to pull together everything it knows at a single point in time and try to show to the student, this is how much college is going to cost.
The more than 360 schools who've signed onto the standards serve about 4 million students altogether. But there are thousands of schools in the country, and Bryce McKibben of the Hope Center for College, Community, and Justice at Temple says the voluntary standards still don't mean comparison shopping is going to be easy.
That doesn't mean the offer itself is going to look the same. Where the actual net price is could be in all sorts of different parts of the page and be hard for a student to tease out so that they actually understand what it is being asked of them to do in the coming year.
McKibben says he'd like to see legislation that requires standardization, not just voluntary guidelines. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
We'll be getting a new PCE report Friday morning. Personal consumption expenditures is the actual phrase, which will give us a sense of where the Fed is with that whole inflation situation. And while prices are still high and that PCE number is probably going to come in higher than Jay Powell would like it to be, sometimes we all need a little bit of a splurge, don't you think? So we checked in with Kristen Bingham. She's the co-owner of Dean's Suites in Portland, Maine, to see whether a more expensive world is eating into our appetite for chocolate.
We raised our prices just about a year ago. We didn't want to. We waited as long as we could and maybe possibly even a little too long. But it finally became really clear that our costs were starting to outweigh our income. The costs of chocolate and cocoa are definitely inching up. Sugar too. The prices of cream and butter have increased by about 10% in the last 2 months. All of this feels like a slow, constant pressure. It's funny because we're retailers, right? But we're also consumers. So as we gear up for the fall and need to stock up on ingredients, we can't help but feel a tightening around our spending. And if we're feeling it, I'm guessing that means that most people are feeling it. Even though Halloween is all but synonymous with chocolate, we know it's definitely more of a grocery store kind of chocolate time. No one I know is giving out truffles and fancy chocolate to trick-or-treaters. What is far bigger for us are the holidays in November and December, and we are definitely in full-on production for Thanksgiving, Hanukkah, and Christmas. I know it seems far off to most people, and that's good. I mean, we're barely into the fall, but we've been building our inventory of our most shelf-stable items for the holidays for several weeks now. We're making little snowmen and stocking up on hot chocolate. We're making and jarring hot fudge and our main sea salt caramel sauce. There are some things that we can't do ahead, so we know we'll have the usual crazy long hours and days and nights in the fourth quarter, but we're doing anything that we can possibly do in advance, we're doing now. Our biggest challenge is anticipating what we'll need for the next few months. And then the next biggest challenge is actually paying for it all now. We know this pattern pretty well, and it's okay. But every year about this time, we go through a bit of a squeeze in regards to cash flow. We need to spend money now on ingredients and gift boxes and marketing so that we're stocked up and ready when the holidays start. We're also getting ready as much as we can for 2024, when we'll celebrate our 20th anniversary year. And since 2024 starts a week after Christmas, we'd better get a jump on it now.
Kristen Bingham, co-owner of Dean Sweets up in Portland, Maine. This final note on the way out today with a nod to both Elizabeth's story about higher oil prices and the coming days of colder weather. Saw this on Reuters that the 60 million American households that use natural gas for home heating, that's out of about 130 million households in this country total, by the way, they are going to see their heating bills fall almost 8% this year because nat gas has gotten cheaper. The 6 million households that heat with oil, an almost 9% increase. For those doing the math, the other however many millions it is households either use electricity, that's about 54 million, or propane, that's about 5 million. All right, we got to go. Here is your moment of economic context. I actually saw this go by in my social feeds a couple of weeks ago, meant to mention it, but it is in the news today again, lucky for me. You might want to take it easy with your breakfast OJ. Orange juice futures prices hit a record high this morning, up 78% year to date. Weather, by the way, is what's going on there. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Justin Dueler, Drew Johnstadt, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.